"Breakfast, wench," he ordered. "I've got a meeting at 9 o'clock at Combined Ops." They sat on her balcony, amongst her miniature forest of pot plants, and ate scrambled eggs and wild mushrooms. "I know it's usually the bride's prerogative, Bugsy, but can we set a date for around the end of next month?"
"So soon. Can you tell me why?"
"Not all of it, but after that we will be going into quarantine and I might be out of circulation for a while."
"Quarantine?" She laid down her fork.
"When we start planning and training for a special operation, we go into total isolation. There have been too many security leaks lately. Too often our boys have walked into sucker punch. We've got a really big one coming up, and the whole group will be quarantined in a special camp. Nobody, not even myself, will be allowed outside contact, not even with parents or wives, until after the operation."
"Where is this camp?"
"I cannot tell you. But if we spend the honeymoon at Victoria Falls, as you wanted, it'll suit me just fine. You can fly back here afterwards and I can go straight into quarantine."
"Oh, darling, it's so soon. There'll be so many arrangements to make. I don't know if Mummy and Daddy can get out here by then."
"I'll telephone them."
"All right," she agreed. "But I hate the thought of you having to leave so soon afterwards."
"I know. It won't always be that way."
He looked at his watch.
"Time to go. I'll be a little late this evening. I want to talk to Sonny. I hear he's living in that boat of his again."
She tried to cover her shock. "Sonny? Craig? Why do you want to see him?" When Roland told her why, she could think of nothing to say. She went on staring at him in appalled silence. Jeanine telephoned him at the police armory as soon as she reached the museum. "Craig, I have to see you."
"Wonderful, I'll make the dinner."
No, immediately. You must get away." He laughed.
"I've only had this job a few months. Even for me it'll be a record."
"Tell them your mother is sick."
"Well, I'm an orphan."
"I know, darling, but this is life and death."
"What did you call me?"
It slipped out.
"Say it again."
"Craig, don't be an idiot."
"Say it."
"Darling."
"Where and when?"
"Half an hour at the bandstand in the gardens, and Craig, it's bad news." She hung up without letting him talk again. She saw him first. He came at a lope, like a St. Bernard puppy, with legs too long and his hair sticking out under the peak of his cap, a frown of worry crumpling up his face. But when he saw her sitting on the steps of the white-painted bandstand, the frown smoothed and his eyes lit with that special soft look that today she found too painful to bear.
"God," he said, "I'd forgotten how lovely you are."
"Let's walk." She couldn't look at him. But when he took her hand, she could not bring herself to pull her fingers out of his. Neither of them spoke again until they reached the river. They stood on the bank and watched a little girl in a white dress and pink ribbons feeding breadcrumbs to the ducks. "I had to tell you first," she said. "I urge you that at least." She felt him go very still beside her. But still she could not look at him. Yet she could not withdraw her hand from his. "Before you say anything, I want to tell you again what I told you before.
I love you, Jan."
"Oh, Craig."
"Do you believe me?"
She nodded and swallowed.
"All right, then, now. You tell me what it is you wanted me to hear."
"Roland has asked me to marry him." His hand began to tremble. "And I said yes."
"Why, Jan?"
She jerked her hand away at last.
"Damn you. Why do you always have to do it?"
"Why?" he persisted.
"I know you love me. Why are you going to do it?"
"Because I love him more," she said, still angry. "If you were me, who would you marry?"
"When you put it that way," he agreed, "I suppose you're right."
Now at last she looked at him. He was very pale.
"Rowley always was the winner. I hope you'll be very happy, Jan."
"Oh, Craig, I'm so sorry."
"Yes, I know, so am I. Can we just leave it now, Jan? There's nothing more to say."
"Yes, there is.
Roland is coming to see you this evening. He's going to ask you to be his best man."
Roland Ballantyne perched on the edge of the operations table.
It was an enormous relief map of Matabeleland. The disposition of the security force elements was shown by small movable counters and their strength by a numbered card set into each counter like a menu holder. Every branch of the force had its own colour. The Ballantine scouts were maroon. They were shown as 250 in Tabas in Dunas barracks, but there was still a patrol of 50 near the Guai, involved in the hot pursuit of the survivors of the previous day's contact. On the opposite side of the operations table, Wing Commander Douglas Hunt Jeffries slapped the wooden pointer into the palm of the other hand. "All right," he nodded. "This is for heads of staff only. Let's go over from the beginning, please." There were just two of them in the operations room, and the red security light above the steel door was burning.
"Codename Buffalo," Roland said. "The object of the operation is the elimination of Josiah Nkunzi and or one or all of his chiefs of staff, Tebi, Chotipo and Tungata."
"Tungata?" Hunt Jeffries asked.
"He's a new one," Roland explained.
"Go on, please."
"We will cull them at the safe house in Lusaka at some date after the 15th of November, when we expect Nkunzi to return from a visit to Hungary and East Germany."
"You'll be able to get intelligence of his return?" Douglas asked, and when Roland nodded, "Can you let me know your source?"
"That's not even for you, Dougie, my boy."
"Very well, as long as you will be certain that Nkunzi is in residence before you move."
"From now on, let's just call him Buffalo."
"How would you go in?"
"We'll go in overland. A column of Land Rovers with Zambian police markings, and all personnel will wear Zambian police uniforms."
Douglas raised an eyebrow. "Geneva Convention?"
"Legitimate ruse of war," Roland countered.
"They'll shoot you if they catch you."
"They would do that anyway, uniforms or not. The answer will be not to let any of our lads get caught."
"All right, you go in by road. Or which one?"
"Livingston to Lusaka."
"A long haul through hostile territory, and our air force has blown the bridges at Kalela."
"There is an alternative route upstream. There'll be a guide waiting to take us through the bush to reach it."
"So, you've covered that bridge, but how do you cross the Zambezi?"
"There's a drift below Kazangula."
"Which you have checked, of course."
"Yeah, on a dummy run. We took a vehicle across using winch and floats in 9 minutes flat. We'll have the entire task force across in under 2 hours. There's a track that'll take us out onto the Great North Road, 50 km north of Livingston."
"Now what about resupply?"
"Well, the guide at Kalea is a white maize farmer, and he has fuel on his farm, and we will back up with helicopters."
"I take it you will use the helicopters to evacuate if you were forced to abort the operation."
Roland nodded. "Well, that's it, Dougie, old bean. Pray it's not necessary."
"Well, let's go on to personnel, then. How many will you use?"
45 scouts. That includes Sergeant Major and myself, and 10 specialists."
"Specialists?"
"Well, we expect to find a pile of documents in Buffalo's HQ, probably so much that we will not be able to bring it all back. We need at least 4 intelligence experts to evaluate on the spot what to keep and what to burn. You pick them for us."
"The other specialists?"
"Medicos, 2 of them. Henderson and his aide. We've used them before."
"Good. Who else?"
"Blast bunnies to clear the house of booby traps to set our own when we leave, and to blow the bridges behind us on our way home."
"Armourers from Salisbury?"
"Well, I can get 2 good lads here in Bulawayo. One is a cousin of mine."
"Fine. Oh, let me have a list of names." Douglas carefully withdrew the stub of his cigarette from the ivory holder, crushed it out, and replaced it with a fresh tube from the packet of gold leaf. "Now, what about the site for the quarantine camp?" he asked. "Have you given it some thought?"
"Yeah, there's the Wanky Safari Lodge on the Det Vlei. It's 2 hours' drive from the Zambezi, and it's been on a caretaker basis since the Wanky Strip was abandoned."
5-star comfort. Scouts are getting soft," Douglas grinned mockingly. "Okay, I'll see you get it."
Douglas made a note and then looked up.
"Now, let's go over the dates. How soon can you be ready to go?"
15th of November. That gives us 8 weeks to assemble the equipment and rehearse the raid."
"Yes, it probably also fits in rather well for the date of your wedding, doesn't it?"
Douglas tapped the ivory holder against his teeth, and delighted in Roland Ballantyne's quick flare of temper.
The timing of the raid has nothing to do with my private affairs. It'll be dictated entirely by Buffalo's movements. In any event, my wedding will take place a week before the start of quarantine. Janine and I will spend our honeymoon at the Victoria Falls Hotel, which is only 2 hours' drive from the camp at Wanky Safari Lodge. She will fly back to Bulawayo on the Airways' scheduled flight, and I will go into quarantine directly from Vic Falls. Douglas lifted a defensive hand and grinned mockingly. I say, do keep your hair on, old man. Just a civil inquiry, that's all. By the way, I think my wedding invitation must have been lost in the post. But Roland had returned to his list and was studying it with all his attention. Douglas Hunt Jeffreys lay on the ample bed in the cool, shuttered bedroom and examined the naked woman who slept beside him. At first she had seemed a most unpromising subject. With her pale, acne-scarred face and disconcerting, staring eyes behind horn-rimmed spectacles, her abrupt, aggressive, almost mannish manner, and the smouldering intensity of the political militant. But stripped of her shapeless sweater and baggy skirts, of her thick woollen socks and crude leather sandals, she had a slim, pale, almost girlish body, with fine, small breasts that Douglas found very much to his taste. When she removed the spectacles, her staring eyes softened into appealing, unfocused myopia. And under Douglas's skillful lips and fingers, she unloosed a tumultuous physical response, which had at first astonished and then delighted him. He found he could induce in her an epileptic passion, a state in which she was almost catatonic and totally susceptible to his will, her depravity limited only by the range of Douglas's fertile imagination. "A murrain on beautiful women," he smiled contentedly to himself. "It's the ugly little ducklings who are the absolute ravers." They had met in the middle of the morning, and now it was, careful not to disturb her, Douglas checked his gold Rolex, it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, even for Douglas, a marathon performance. Poor lamb is exhausted. He craved a cigarette, but decided to give her 10 minutes more. There was no hurry. He could afford to lie a little longer and leisurely review his case. Like many good controllers, Douglas had found that a sexual relationship with his female agents, and occasionally even with some of his male agents, was an effective tool of manipulation, a shortcut to the dependencies and loyalties that were so desirable in his trade. This case was a perfect example. Without the physical lever, Dr. Layla St. John would be a difficult and unpredictable subject, whereas with it, she had become one of his best agents ever. Douglas Hunt Jeffreys, by a fluke of war, was a born Rhodesian. His father had come out to Africa at the beginning of Hitler's war to command the Royal Air Force training station at Gwelo. He had met and married a local girl, and Douglas had been delivered in 1941 by the Air Force doctor. The family had returned to England at the end of his father's tour of duty, and Douglas had followed the well-worn family path to Eton and then on to the Royal Air Force. After that, there had been an unusual diversion in his career, and he found himself in British military intelligence. Back in 1964, when Ian Smith came to power in Rhodesia and started making the first threatening noises about breaking with Britain in a unilateral declaration of independence, Douglas Hunt Jeffreys had been the perfect choice of an agent to place in the field. He had returned to Rhodesia, taken up his Rhodesian nationality, joined the Rhodesian Air Force, and begun immediately to mould his way up the ladder of command. He was now chief coordinator for British intelligence throughout the territory, and Dr. Layla St. John was one of his recruits. Naturally, she had no idea as to who was her ultimate employer. Any suggestion of military intelligence, no matter to which country it belonged, would have sent her scampering up the nearest tree like a frightened cat. Douglas grinned lazily at his own imagery. Layla St. John believed herself to be a member of a small, courageous group of left-wing guerrillas intent on wresting the land of her birth from its racialist fascist conquerors and delivering it unto the joys of Marxist communism. On the other hand, the concern of Douglas Hunt Jeffreys and his government was to arrive at the swiftest settlement acceptable to the United Nations and to the United States, France, West Germany and their other Western allies, and to withdraw from an embarrassing, untidy and costly situation with what dignity and dispatch they could still muster, preferably leaving in charge the least objectionable of the African guerrilla leaders.